Evaluating a session of the Indiana General Assembly, any session of the General Assembly, is a lot like analyzing a suspected tornado. Now, everyone along the storm's path knows something happened thanks to strong winds, ear-popping pressure changes, and that telltale rumble that's often likened to the vibration caused by a passing freight train. It's impossible to get the big picture, however, until survey teams from the National Weather Service fan out to measure the storm's footprint and gauge its intensity, structure by structure, fallen tree by fallen tree. Only after ruling out straight-line winds can the experts proclaim the storm a tornado and rate it on the Fujita scale. Hi, I'm John Schwanis, and on this week's show, our last of the 2022 season, we'll assess the just-concluded legislative session with our survey team, four of the state's most respected journalists. Don't go away. Indiana lawmakers, from the State House to your house. And joining me to assess the Indiana General Assembly's 2022 session are four people who followed most every twist and turn. Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Media and host of Indiana Week in Review, which, as I like to say, airs on many of these same public broadcasting stations. Caitlin Lang, State House reporter for the Indianapolis Star. Nikki Kelly, State House bureau chief for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. And Erica Heron, education reporter for the Indianapolis Star. As some of you know, I'm always on a never-ending quest to find the perfect metaphor, or even a workable metaphor.
Yeah, I don't know.
or even just a half-baked metaphor to describe the legislative process. And I may have hit a new low, because at the top of the show I talked about it. Assessing the General Assembly is like kind of studying the aftermath of a suspected tornado. There's a lot of fury and noise and bluster and vibration at the outset, but it's not until, you know, the teams go out and get the aerial shots and figure out what direction the trees fell that they really know what went on. I'm not saying there was damage, just sizing up the situation.
I think some people would say there's damage.
All right, just how great is, we'll start with you, Brent, how great is that metaphor in terms of...
It depends on who you talk to. Some people would think that's a really apt metaphor. There are some people who were really unhappy with what happened this session, notably gun regulation advocates, obviously being probably the most upset about what happened. But certainly if you're a transgender person in the state or an ally of transgender people in the state, you don't like what happened in the General Assembly this year. And I think there are many in the business community, larger businesses, not so much small businesses, who are not as thrilled as they could be with what happened ultimately at the end of the session with tax cuts. So, yeah, I think there's the story of the session really can't be told until the, like any session, but particularly this one, until the end of session, because there was so much really big stuff, I think, that was in flux right up until almost the very end.
And that's what I was suggesting, not that there's damage to be assessed, as although I suppose in some sectors you're right, that could be the case, but it's more just a situation of the proverbial dust has to settle a bit, because you know, there were several bills in those final hours that became the proverbial Christmas tree bill, you know, or the hodgepodge, call it what you will, where a little of this, a little of that, and it does take time to sort it out. Are all the cards on the table now, Caitlin, do you think? Are there any surprises lurking still?
I mean, we still don't know what Governor Holcomb's going to do on some of these bills. We still have the permitless carry bill out. We still have the ban on, you know, transgender girls participating in girls' sports. We don't necessarily know what Holcomb will do on those, especially with the permitless carry bill. Is he going to go against his ISP head of the police, or is he, you know, going to side with the more, you know, the conservative lawmakers who passed the bill?
Well, Nikki, there are a lot of ways to judge a session. You know, we can look, you know, 849 bills and 20% passed. I mean, how do you measure the session? Where, how should Hoosiers measure the session in terms of whether this was productive? Because I had legislative leaders here last week.
I mean, I think,
and depending on who I ask, it was either a waste of time, an exercise in cultural warfare, or it was a great service to the state of Indiana.
Well, that's always what it comes down to, is perspective. I mean, the fact is that I think there are 177 bills on the governor's desk, and the vast majority of those are bipartisan bills that, you know, they're not huge, sexy issues, but they make small tweaks to law that help people. And then you've got sort of the 10% that get all the attention, you know. And so they always get stuff done that helps people, but, you know, there are definitely differences in whether some things also hurt people. And there's also the second, like a third category of, well, we could have helped more people. You know, we had this huge surplus and we debated tax cuts. And what we heard from Democrats was, why are we debating tax cuts when we have so many unmet needs? We still have a partially funded, you know, pre-K program that only helps, you know, a few thousand kids a year. You know, we still have things that we need to do next year with public health. And so there are some issues about, you know, we could have used some of that money to help people right away.
Or even going further than that, if you wanted to cut taxes, they could have cut taxes that would more immediately provide relief to Hoosiers. Mm-hmm. And that's what Republicans...
Such as with the gas.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Suspending the gas tax, a temporary suspension of the gas tax and the sales and or the sales tax on gasoline. But, you know, Speaker Todd Houston in particular, we didn't really hear Rod Bray talk about this a lot, but Todd Houston in particular was constantly banging the drum with the tax cut package of, we are putting money in the pockets of Hoosiers. And... It's going to be a while before any of that money goes back to Hoosiers. And two, it's not going to be very much. The first tax cut that will take effect are the two utility tax eliminations. And that's a couple of dollars on the average Hoosier's bill, monthly bill, which is not nothing, but it's literally like $1 or $2 depending on the size of your bill. And then the individual income tax cut is phased out over at least 7 years. And for a Hoosier making $50,000 a year, next year they would save $40. For a Hoosier making about $30,000 a year, which was the median wage from 2015 to about 2019, it'll be $24. So,
and
I mean,
no guarantee that the 7-year phase-in takes place as planned. The state has to have growth of 2% in revenue, and some other things have to happen in terms of retiring. So no guarantee there.
No, not after that first cut. The first cut is automatic. But after that, maybe it'll take effect. Maybe it'll take a couple more years to take effect.
Erica. I'll get rid of my metaphor once and for all. I'll have official ceremony and we'll put the tornado away. But I got to justify one more thing here. One of the reasons I brought that up, again, in the moment, at the start of the session, it was just so much sound and fury. And I mean, everybody was rattling the cage, so to speak. And even organization day, there was a thought that, you know, this is such an outrage to have these emergency measures and the imposition of vaccine mandates in the private workplace that we've got to help people now. We're not even going to wait for the session. And education issues, there was the same sort of thing. This is a desperate need. But then, in keeping with my metaphor, see, it works, right? It just kind of calmed down and people had to assess. Is that a fair? I mean, why so much sound and fury at the beginning? Was it just COVID or was education had people so fired up because of national concerns and sort of the drumbeat that had sounded nationally?
Yeah, I mean, that was a lot of it, right? We've been having this conversation really since the last session ended. You know, we saw last session ended in May, and that whole summer, you know, starting June, July, August, it was lots of sound, lots of fury, lots of angry parents and just Hoosiers in general who were frustrated about COVID, who were frustrated about what they thought maybe was happening in their schools. And so we had this long buildup. You know, that started last summer. We had to wait until January to maybe try and do something about it. And then by the time that happened, you know, it was kind of unclear of what actually needed to be done still. So, you know, for my perspective, all the bills I watched, it was a lot of sound, a lot of fury, to then not end up getting maybe a ton done, because the bills that we spent the most time talking about didn't end up passing at the end of the day. So Nikki's talking about these different categories of bills. I think there's a fourth category, and it's the one we spent a ton of time talking about that never got across the finish line.
Well, it is interesting when we had Greg Taylor, the Senate Democratic leader, and his counterpart from the House, Phil Giaquinto, they were saying that to them, the session was as much about killing bills as it was about promoting bills or advancing bills. This session, was it an argument for protracted deliberation? Because, again, if people say the process moved slowly, but if it hadn't moved slowly, maybe we would have ended up with a lot of COVID-related measures that seem now to be unnecessary. I don't know.
Yeah, Speaker Todd Houston talked about that. I mean, it's hard to say anything, but the House caved on the vaccine mandate bill. They wanted something that would have essentially forced employers to provide particularly the religious exemptions, which was the big one that would have really blown it up. And because all you needed was just to say, I want a religious exemption, and you had to be granted it. And at the end of the day, what the Senate passed and what ultimately the House agreed to was current law, essentially. There was one little addition, which was if you've had COVID in the last 3 months, you don't have to get the vaccine. But that only is theoretically a short-term exemption because eventually that 3 months expires. So I can't describe it as any way but the House caved, but Speaker Houston talked about things had changed a lot from the start of session. One, the COVID situation in the state had improved, as it has across the country. Cases are temporarily, at least, down. But also, we had the Supreme Court rulings on the Biden administration's proposed mandates. They upheld it for healthcare workers, which were the largest group by far of people who came to the state house to argue for the state bill and will now not be helped at all by anything that that state bill does. But then the larger OSHA mandate, which would have applied to any employer of at least 100 employees, that was struck down. You had companies not really moving forward with some of their mandates that we thought they might. And so I think the whole situation just quieted. And he even acknowledged that. It's that where they were in January was not where they were in March.
And under normal circumstances, and I suppose that's a bad phrase to use in connection with a unprecedented global health crisis, but normally we could argue, I suppose, that when things subside, the threat subsides, that the issue goes away. But now we've got oral arguments in the Indiana Supreme Court dealing with the whole question of emergency powers, which will sort of dredge this up again.
Remember that, is
the wind out of those sails, do you think, Erica, or is that still I know this is off the education topic somewhat, but you're educating us, like, you're educating us on the issue. There doesn't seem to be the same vigor, but I'm sure we'll still be going through that process. And it's already established,
we'll still go through the process. I'm not sure though that we'll see the same outrage, and level of, I guess, interest that we saw, early on. I don't know that we'll have.
I think on the emergency powers issue, basically we're talking about future stuff, right?
Yeah.
We've moved past, we no longer have a health emergency, here in the state. And so now that case is all about just future concerns about executive versus legislative powers. It doesn't really, even though it was started because of COVID, doesn't really have anything to do with that.
And that issue, even though it's subsided in relation to that narrow topic, COVID, that theme still exists, certainly between you have the executive branch versus the legislature. And in fact, that probably is what led to the first veto.
Absolutely.
Maybe the only. We'll see if it's the first or the only veto of this session. One of only, what, five or six that the governor, I think it's only the fifth that he's done during his entire tenure as governor. But that was about this friction between.
Yeah, the legislature really wanted to flex a little on sort of oversight of executive branch. And so the first veto, for anyone who doesn't know, had to do with some language they put in a blockchain bill. So again, we're just adding random language to
the last day of session.
Some language from a bill that died in the House that basically changed how agencies can do rulemaking.
And well, died in the Senate.
Died in the Senate. Sorry, it passed the House, died in the Senate. And the really awful thing about that one is the committee didn't even hear testimony from the opposition. They heard testimony from one supporter, then they delayed it to the next week, and then the chairman was like, we're not hearing this bill.
Because the supposition was, next year.
We'll do it next year. And they still stuck it in a bill. And, and so the governor definitely vetoed it.
And one of the
there was also, I think it's important to note, because this also goes into this lawsuit playing out. There was language put into that bill at the end from the original House bill that even the House didn't pass, which had to do with the Attorney General's office reviewing these proposed rules and being able to basically spike them. And that, especially for emergency rules, which happen all the time, by the way,
right?
Like not during a public health. Particularly the governor pointed out the Board of Animal Health passes emergency rules dealing with disease outbreaks.
Gaming Commission.
Exactly.
Any number of things.
So, and the Attorney General's office has to review them. It says in a timely manner, but doesn't actually say how quickly. And as the governor pointed out, what does that mean? What does timely manner mean? Is the Attorney General's office going to hold these things up past when they need to be in effect? And so I think it's also, and again, even the House didn't pass that language, and all of a sudden it made it into a bill at the end. And I think that's a little further tension between the governor's office and the attorney general's office.
Is it more tension where needed? Because those two, for those who don't follow the process, you may look and say, R is behind this name. R is behind that name.
That's two attorneys general in a row, by the way.
And that is not what, I mean, they have been at odds, well, on this other lawsuit we talked about. I mean, that's, you wanted to have the Republican attorney general. He went to court and said the governor shouldn't even have an ability to challenge this law. And I alone should decide what's constitutional and not. So do you think that's also at play here?
I mean,
that friction, that sort of part of this internecine warfare that we've seen bubbling. Well, it's not just bubbling below the surface, I guess.
It's above the
sometimes
surface.
Sometimes it's a
guy. It was in a veto letter.
Yeah, I think that does come into play because, I mean, I just can't help but think they're probably not always going to be on the same page when it comes to whether these emergency orders are necessary. The other interesting thing in his veto letter, towards the end, there was he did sort of question if lawmakers have the legal ability. There's a provision in there, I think, that they have to review emergencies or emergency
rules
if it's been in effect for more than 90 days. So he questioned if they have the legal authority for that, and that gets right back to the lawsuit, I would say, of how much power do and should lawmakers have in Indiana?
Well, and it wasn't lawmakers in general. It was the legislative council, which is a small group of legislative leaders basically acting as proxy for all 150 lawmakers.
Which is a totally a creation of the legislature.
Yep.
It does not appear anywhere in the Indiana Constitution, which is, I think, part of what... And there was also, by the way, language in that veto override bill having to do with broadband, which I don't think any of us really noticed, that was put in very late, that Governor Holcomb says would interfere with some of the, or several of the projects, apparently.
I think he said in 28 counties, it would be a total of, $154 million of programs that are funded by the so-called Ready Economic Development Grants.
It wasn't just that.
And that has to do with education. Broadband has always been, we saw certainly during COVID. See, I'm going to,
bring it back in.
Bring it back in here. I mean, we saw during COVID that broadband is essential to kids,
absolutely.
Whether their classroom becomes the family room or the kitchen or the basement. I mean, how much of a blow would it be to not have the ability to wire these large portions, perhaps, of the state?
Oh, it's hugely important for all kinds of reasons, but particularly when we're talking about education, there were a lot of families who, you know, couldn't access the online learning that, you know, their kids were doing. There were teachers who had to go into their school buildings to teach remotely because they didn't have the capability to do it from their home like everyone else. And even though we seem to be moving into, you know, kind of a new era, the pandemic has calmed down, kids are back in classrooms, back in school, we know schools are going to be using these virtual learning days, these remote learning days, you know, more often going forward. They have new capability. They figured out how to use these. You know, people are, you know, kind of crying about the end of the snow day, but, you know, we have kids who are really behind, and so every, you know, extra day we can kind of keep them learning is going to be hugely important, but it's just going to create wider gaps if that learning is only available to people who have broadband.
And importantly, I think people need to remember, too, when we're talking about broadband access, we're starting to, there are still Hoosiers who do not have access to the internet, period.
Right.
But that group is becoming smaller, in part because of the work that the state has been doing over the last few years under the Holcomb administration. So we're starting to move away from just getting them internet, period, to getting them the kind of internet they need to be able to do these virtual learning opportunities. Just having the really basic internet isn't necessarily going to work when you're having to do a video stream from a classroom.
Well, and you think, too, you know, one of the things that they did do this year was limit how many asynchronous, you know, learning days kids can use because they want these virtual learning days to be live lessons. Well, that live stream, you know, of a video chat between a teacher and all of her students, that requires, you know, a higher level of internet than downloading a worksheet and doing it, which is not what we want kids to be doing when they're at home learning.
Again, for those who don't follow the process, usually when a bill goes to a committee and the committee chair decides not to hear the bill, that means it's done. Again, not technically, I guess, anything that passes one chamber, et cetera, can come back. How atypical, Nikki, was this, and is there any lasting damage to the institution or the process from this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we see this on a handful of bills every year, but this one was such an interesting thing. And the Senate did hear the bill. They gutted it, committee.
Right. It went back to basically the
correct.
Old licensing structure.
With some slight, you know, tweaks.
Improvements to get the people licenses faster, too, which was a complaint.
Right.
And then The bill died the next day because of a deadline quirk. Because they strip and inserted it, it would have had to go to rules. It was the second reading. It was the committee report deadline, so it died. So, okay, they're like, but we're going to keep it going. But did they keep it going with what the committee passed? No. They started again with what the House passed. So, again, we are back to language that had not passed a committee, even a committee, in the Senate. And so I get why people see that and are like, oh, wow, that's rough.
I'll play devil's advocate, or at least advocate on behalf of the Republicans who passed the bill. I think if the bill had made it to the Senate floor, we saw the final vote was 30-20. I think there would have been the votes to change the bill back to the way it came out of the House, which is ultimately what passed the Senate. I think it was just... So I think ultimately you get to the same result at the end of the day. I just think the way it went, the way they went about it.
A self-inflicted wound, perhaps, if in fact it was a wound.
Yeah, I mean, if they really wanted to advance the bill, they could have had the Rules Committee meet emergently that morning and pass it out. They decided not to do that, and so, you know, they got it eventually anyway, just a little later and in a more circuitous path.
I do wonder, though, I think there is a chance it could have changed to not what it ended up being. Like, you know, I look at Ohio where they passed it for 21 and over. I would envision...
Which is something the Senate had been pushing.
Yeah, so I would envision something like that, a change like that could have happened if they had let it come to seconds for amendment. So I don't think we for sure got the final bill we would have otherwise.
For those Hoosiers who say, you know, this whole system, I'm tuning out because it's rigged, we know it doesn't matter. I can go and testify for hours, as we saw on some bills, you know, 8, 9, what was the longest hearing?
Probably 9 hours.
9 hour. And then the vote comes and it's essentially opposite in some cases of what the majority, the overwhelming majority of the people testifying had to say. Again, any damage here, do you think?
There were certainly some unforced errors this year on the part of the legislature. But we did see, in a few instances, committees also listening to people that came and spoke to them. The partisan school boards bill, we had everyone that came to testified against that bill.
And this is where a school board would-be school board members run as either an R or a D.
Yeah,
or,
exactly, which is, right now, we don't do that, right? We have nonpartisan races. And so no one came to testify in support of that bill, and so they didn't move it forward because they said no one wants this, even though it polled well with our constituents. No one cared enough to, show up. So there are instances where they do listen to people who come and testify. So I think there is evidence to support, people coming and continuing to be part of the process. And I think that's a lot of what happened, with some of these education bills, too, with the, House Bill 1134. They didn't end up passing that bill, and I think one of the reasons, anyway, was because of just how many people showed up to speak against the bill, how many emails they got. There was a lot of pushback on that, and I think
Let's dive into that. Call it what you will, the divisive topic bill, the curriculum bill, the critical race theory bill. It comes many names, many monikers, but basically would have handcuffed teachers and said, there are certain things you can't address, or if you do address them, you have to address them in a certain way. And that did get considerable pushback from school boards, from teachers.
On both sides, by the way.
On both
sides.
Because
there were folks who wanted that bill or a version of that bill who said, well, this doesn't go nearly far enough, even in its original form.
Are we done with this kind of spasm of those issues, or is...
I don't think so, but, it's a long time till the next legislative session. It's going to be a different climate. Will be after the election, and I do think the upcoming election did have a large role in getting these issues to the forefront of lawmakers' minds. So I don't know if it'll come back as forcefully, especially the critical race theory issues. I don't know that one will come back as strongly, just because it had such a rocky session, on that topic. But maybe the harmful materials bill, just because that is something that's, come up in years past when it wasn't an election year. So there seems to be some appetite outside of, election stuff.
And even if those two failed, certainly another education bill that I think when all was said and done got almost unanimous support in both chambers was the notion of having parental, if not parental oversight, and certainly not an advisory committee, or panel, which was with veto power, essentially, which is one thing also that died. But basically just saying, hey, if you're a taxpayer, if you're a resident, or if you're a breathing human, you can show up and testify and talk to the school board before business is conducted?
Most school boards, even though they were not previously required to have public comment, took public comment. The only reason we saw that stop in some cases was just because of how out of control these meetings were getting, how disruptive some of the people who were coming to the meetings were being. We saw threats of violence against school board members, against teachers, administrators. And so this was a really unusual moment. There were no school boards and schools who were coming and saying, no, we don't want to hear from people. We don't want to talk to our parents. All they asked for was some reasonable limits on, can we limit the amount of time we spend hearing from people? Can we make it so that we're only hearing from, our actual constituents and taxpayers and not someone who comes, from out of state to talk about an issue? That one did have a lot of broad support and got
passed. Whether some of these issues come back, though, and I think Caitlin made a really good point about the election, too. I think the election was driving some of these issues because you had Republicans worried about primary elections. And I think they have more primary challenges than we've had in at least a decade. Mm-hmm. I think
from the right.
From the right. From the right. Yeah. If they're a Republican primary, they're not coming at them from the left. So
politics 101, yes.
Someone
2022 style.
Someone right at the end of session talked to me and said that, the Senate was trying to say, the Senate, which was less concerned about primaries than the House was, was saying, hey, we don't need to go this far. Let's cool down and let's stop some of these things. And ultimately, the Senate did stop some of those things. But that person made the argument to me that what the Senate has done is perhaps guaranteed an even more conservative House in the future, because now House members can't go back to their constituents and say, here's what we delivered for you. They can say, we tried, but they didn't ultimately deliver some of these things. And will that ultimately mean that some of these primary challenges will be successful and you will have an even more conservative Indiana House than it currently is, which doesn't seem possible, but is absolutely
possible. Makes the toughest job in town that's hurting the cats even tougher.
John Jacob is considered an outsider, obviously, in the Indiana General Assembly. He doesn't caucus with Republicans because they don't want him to caucus with them, but you could have a General Assembly that's now, or at least an Indiana House Republican caucus, that's a quarter John Jacobs.
Buckle your seatbelts. Nikki, final word. I can't believe we're out of time already.
Oh, we're out of time?
I know. Can you believe it? We talked about what people won't notice, either because the bills didn't pass or because in the case of taxes, it's phased in. It's a nickel here. It's a dime there. If we reconvene this session in a year and we say, now that was the bill that really mattered, for better or for worse, what's it going to be?
Oh, gosh. There's some economic development stuff that
don't get too,
the IEDC
wanted. Better start
wanted.
Scratching the surface. We're almost out of time. Don't give us a treatise here.
Maybe that one would have more, in
terms of grant funding or ready grants and those those types of things.
And just getting companies to come.
Yeah.
What do you guys
think?
Any other things that will lurk? That are lurking.
I think the gun bill's a big one.
Guns,
if it becomes law.
And we talked about if there is a mishap and it becomes law, and there's an officer.
Even if it ultimately wouldn't have made a difference, it's going to be.
Well, it still becomes fodder in a news story as background. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
The ban on transgender girls playing sports. That's obviously going to have a huge impact on that population. So I think we'll see the impacts of that. We'll hear more conversations about it.
And probably a lawsuit.
Yeah,
In fact, the American Civil Liberties Union, I think, has already essentially said it will do that.
Mm-hmm. I think, tax cuts, I think it will be interesting to see what are we looking like financially next year. Mm-hmm. Was it the right decision come a year from now?
You were as enlightening and entertaining today as you have been throughout the session. Hoosiers, thank you for that. I thank you for that. Go get some sleep. Again, my guests have been Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Media, Caitlin Lang, State House reporter for the Indianapolis Star, Nikki Kelly, State House bureau chief for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette, and Erica Heron, education reporter for the Indianapolis Star. I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to come back in January for the start of the General Assembly's 2023 session and Indiana lawmakers' 42nd season. Until then, take care.